Hello and welcome. This is an audio recording of an IFG live event.
I'm Jill Rutter. I'm a senior fellow here.
Welcome to the latest IFG podcast. Today we're going to be looking at net zero, where we published a big report out last Monday. Do look it up on our website. UK political debate is dominated by COVID, Brexit, or the economic fallout of both. But actually, government really should be taking seriously the other big issue in their inbox, climate change. You might remember back in February, before we were all hit by COVID, we were worrying about the impacts of severe flooding. And last year, Prime Minister Theresa May signed up the UK in legislation to become a net zero greenhouse gas emitter by 2050. Boris Johnson's not necessarily taken on much of her legacy, but that is one commitment that he himself has reiterated. So he's committed to getting the UK to net zero by 2050, but does he know how to get there? And does he have a plan, not just to make the nation more resilient in the wave of future epidemics, but also to adapt to climate change? So this will be a big issue in ministers' inbox, you know, which they should be focusing a lot of time and attention on, even if COVID and Brexit weren't eating up all their bandwidth. Quite difficult to see how they might make the time to do it. But anyway, we produced our report with some ideas on what the government might want to do next to meet its climate change target. And I'm joined here by two of its authors, my colleague Tom Sass, a senior researcher, and Emma Norris, our director of research and declaration of interest. I'm another author. And kudos to Marcus Shepherd, who did all the fantastic graphics in the report. But we're not the only people advising the government this week. On Thursday, Parliament published the output of its Climate Assembly, a citizens' assembly convened by four select committees. Becky Willis from Lancaster University, former Sustainable Development Commissioner and author of Too Hot to Handle, which looks at the tortured politics of climate change, has been intimately involved. She's here to tell us what to make of it. And our final guest, in some ways, is possibly the man responsible for the government committing last year to the net zero target, at least with his colleagues on the Committee of Climate Change, the CEO of the Committee on Climate Change, Chris Stark. And that, actually, for a government that likes things that are genuinely world-leading, is a world-leading bit of governance that, as our report shows, has been copied by a number of other countries. It was the CCC that did the analysis that convinced the government that it could, after all, set a net zero target. So I'm going to start off by asking Chris. Chris, I think some polling we cite in our report says only a third of the public knows what net zero means. So for the other two thirds, what does net zero mean?
Net zero has become a slogan, hasn't it? It's more than a slogan, though. It's a scientific concept. What it really means is reaching the point where there are no overall addition to the stock of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. So globally, we have to reach that goal. That's the point when we will halt the warming of the planet, the stuff that we're really addressing with all of our climate change work. Here in the UK, we have a national goal for net zero too, and that's what we advised on last year, and that is now the UK's target to reach net zero emissions by 2050. What that means is reducing all the sources of greenhouse gas emissions that we have right across society to zero or near zero as much as we can. And for any sources of emissions that remain, we need to compensate for that with an equal amount of removal of carbon from the atmosphere. So it's a huge challenge overall, all encapsulated in this single net zero slogan that we've been talking so much about.
How hard will it be for the government to get there? It's easy for government to sign up to ambitious targets. Governments quite like doing that. Sometimes they're not that feasible. Is this one a practical target?
It's definitely practical. I mean, I think one of the really interesting things from the work that we've done over the years in the CCC is reveal how practical it really is. So we've been at this now for 12 years. We understand in some detail now the things that we need to do to get to net zero. It does involve a lot of change. So in almost every area of life, we use fossil fuels and cause these greenhouse gas emissions that lead to climate change. We're talking about changing that pretty fundamentally. But the steps to get to net zero are things that we now understand. And I think we can say with some confidence that they're pretty cost effective as well. So this isn't about sort of fantasy discussions. It's about very practical things that cut emissions. It's about moving away from petrol and diesel cars, for example. It's about heating homes in different ways. It's about different types of industries, different approaches to industries. Things that we've known for a while, but now really need to be put into practice. And that's one of the messages we've been giving government for a while now, of course.
Emma, one of the things that was quite interesting, and we noted at the Institute of Government when the government set this net zero target last year, was at the same time the Climate Change Committee produced its annual assessment of UK progress and said that the UK was off track to meet the then less ambitious target of achieving just an 80% reduction over 1990 emissions by 2050. So in our report, we set out what the barriers are to progress on climate change. Do you want to just set those out for our listeners in handy form?
Sure. Thanks, Jill. So as you say, in the report, we say that that exactly as Chris says, net zero is feasible, but government hasn't yet confronted the scale of the task ahead if it really wants to achieve net zero, and that there are seven big barriers that it needs to overcome if it is going to hit that target. The top barrier is the lack of a coherent plan for getting us to 2050. At the moment, neither businesses nor individuals have much sense of how we get from here, where we are today, to achieving that goal in 2050. I think, you know, the next barrier is related, and it's about consistency. Policy and regulatory frameworks have been all over the place, you know, in the last kind of decade or more, particularly in transport and housing, two of the toughest industries to crack. So, you know, tax subsidies for electric cars have been in flux. Things like the Zero Carbon Home Standard was cancelled. The Green Deal was abandoned. Some of the people that we spoke to in our research talked about feeling burned by the constant policy and regulatory change they've experienced. There's also a big coordination barrier. Net zero is only going to happen if the Prime Minister signals that this is one of his absolute top priorities. But at the moment, responsibility for net zero and indeed the presidency of COP sits with the business secretary. Now, BEIS lacks the clout needed over other departments, given this is a massive cross-government issue to really bring them together. And it's also a department that's going to be extremely busy dealing with the fallout of the worst recession in decades. So, you know, the Prime Minister needs to take hold of net zero himself. Responsibility needs to shift to Cabinet Office. Then, of course, you've got the barrier of costs. Ministers need to work out how they're going to minimise the cost of net zero. Even minimising them, they're going to be substantial, and they need to allocate those costs fairly. And critically, the Treasury's got to be fully bought into that process, and it hasn't always been fully bought in the past. Then you've got the barrier of capability. Government needs to have the right skills to hand to make a whole series of key decisions on net zero. So that means having people in government who really understand delivery, because net zero, if nothing else, is a huge delivery challenge, and one that's especially tough for government, given how often it struggles with delivering big projects and policies like these, the Green Deal being a kind of case in point. On the capability side, government also needs more science and engineering expertise to hand, and engineering at the moment is very underrepresented in Whitehall. Consent is our next big C in the barriers. It's really hard to overstate the importance of engaging citizens in net zero. Governments are going to need to persuade people to accept massive intrusive changes to their homes, to their diets, to transport. So government needs a way of building consent for the measures that they're going to have to introduce. And I'm sure we're going to talk more about that in light of the Climate Assembly. And then finally, in a break from C words, there needs to be effective scrutiny by Parliament and by other bodies to hold government to account for net zero. For instance, there are very rarely debates in the House of Commons on climate change, so scrutiny arrangements really have to be improved. Those are the seven big barriers standing in the way of us and net zero being achieved at the moment. At least
I think someone did suggest we could have made the last one a seven by talking about challenge from the politicians to government, but too late. It was six C's and an S. Becky, you've written sort of quite a bit on the politics of climate change. You've been around the blocks, and I think you used to do inductions for wannabe MPs about climate change, trying to bring them up to speed. I'm just wondering if you sort of, you know, look at that list and would add anything on the politics of climate change and how we actually might move this up the political agenda, or is it actually better to make progress without it becoming a hot topic political issue?
Yeah, so my research with politicians, with members of parliament, threw up some surprises for me, really. It wasn't a lack of understanding of the problem that was holding MPs back. It was a lack of confidence that there would be support both amongst their parliamentary peers and amongst the wider amongst the wider public that there would be support for climate action. And I mean, really interestingly, a lot of MPs felt that if they were speaking out on climate change, they'd be sort of seen as a freak or a zealot. Those are the kinds of language that they used. So I think as a result of that, what you found is that climate action has just been centered on, you know, the particular department that's responsible for it. At the moment, that's BEIS, the business department. And it really hasn't spread wider because other politicians haven't seen the merit, both, you know, either in terms of their own career or in terms of wider public support of championing this issue. And obviously, that's a huge missed opportunity because if you look at departments like housing, communities and local government, what we do with land and buildings has an enormous impact on our carbon emissions. You know, you can see that if you look at the US, the US has double the emissions per person to the UK. That's not because they're twice as rich and certainly not because they're twice as happy. It's because they have bigger buildings, their settlements are more spread out. So if we're going to be serious about getting to net zero, we've got to push this all the way across government. And that means engaging MPs who at the moment don't think it's their job to do that.
That's really interesting. We're going to come on a bit later to whether the Climate Assembly might open the way for MPs not to see this as a political hot potato that they need to pass on to someone else as rapidly as possible. So we've identified a whole bunch of problems. At the centre of our proposals is the idea that there's a lack of coordination. Emma was talking about the lack of clout in the business department. And I think Becky was touching on the lack of a comprehensive plan. We do, after all, have a plan. We have the the Clean Growth Strategy published in 2017. We're promised a plan next year, a new net zero plan. Tom, what does the government need to do to come up with a credible plan? What does it need to look like?
So I think there's two separate questions, really. There's what does a sort of credible, convincing net zero plan look like? And then what sort of capacity or function do you need to sort of develop and implement that plan? So on the first question, BEIS's clean growth strategy, our verdict on that was it's a sort of classic strategy produced by a bit of a weak or a not very powerful department, which includes a kind of list of probably desirable measures, but not a sort of comprehensive decade by decade strategy for how every part of government will get to where it needs to get to. And if you look at some of the commitments from other parts of government beyond the sort of business and energy sector in that strategy, they are a bit weak or a bit vague. So in terms of what's needed in a net zero plan, I think your starting point has to be each sector, and that includes sort of housing, transport, agriculture, industry, and so on, needs to have a view of where it is now and what actions need to be taken and when in order to get it on track for a sort of net zero trajectory. Where technology is uncertain, you then need much more clarity about when decisions will be taken and on what basis. And that was one of the clear problems that we came across, was that there was too much uncertainty there, and often the sort of lack of technological certainty was used as a reason to delay decision making. So then that net zero plan needs to bring each of those sectoral approaches together into one plan, look at the dependencies between those areas. So for example, our choices about how much we go for hydrogen will have a big impact on our plans in the housing and transport sector, or our plans for onboarding electric vehicles will have a big impact on our energy grid. So you need to manage those dependencies and bring them together. Now, when we looked at that as a plan and what would be needed, and we looked at BEIS, which is at the moment responsible for producing it, I think us and the sort of people we spoke to sort of decided that actually BEIS really doesn't have the capacity to develop and implement that type of plan. You've mentioned some of the problems around it being one of the less powerful departments. So our argument really is that you need to move that responsibility to a new net zero unit in the Cabinet Office. And that unit would bring together expertise and sort of analytical capability from across government and sort of sit there at the centre of government as a way to drive this and both develop the plan, but also hold government departments to account for delivering it. And we think that that unit would need sort of much more central backing, both from the Prime Minister and from a senior sort of Cabinet Office minister to ensure that that plan was implemented.
Okay, and so any nominations for that senior Cabinet Office minister? Maybe it's not your role to make the cabinet, but I think it's quite interesting because that's a bit of what the government's doing now on its central coordination around Brexit preparations, which is overseen by Michael Gove. Chris, what's the CCC going to be looking for when the government produces its net zero plan? What will get it tick in the box from your members?
Well, there's a lot to do. So, I mean, it's important to say that the clean growth strategy, just as Tom says, it kind of has all the right bits, but not nearly at the right, you know, the right kind of volume. So, you know,
sounds very Morecambe and Wise version.
It does, yeah.
All
the right notes, just not necessarily in the right order. So, I mean, there is a big challenge here. I mean, it's worth saying, I mean, we interact with the government a lot, ministers and officials. I think they understand the size of the challenge here. So it's a mission, really, and I think that's best how we look at it. That to get to net zero is pretty much kind of turning over the whole capital stock of a country in something like 20, 30 years. Tremendously exciting if you view it as a mission like that, but it is a fundamental change in every sector. So what we're looking for is a plan that brings that together. That doesn't mean that there should be one place that we look to see all of this, but it does mean that there needs to be a coherence across government in delivering that. Now, interestingly, the government has set up so much of this already. So you already have Grant Shapps talking about a decarbonisation plan for transport, for example, something we've really been crying out for. The Treasury are doing a review on how we pay for all that. That's absolutely essential because that's going to look at some of the fiscal tools to drive decarbonisation across the whole economy. You've got industry plans. You've got a housing plan of sorts, at least with new housing building standards. All of this stuff needs to be brought together in one place to at least understand how it's all going to interact. And that's the thing that's missing at the moment. If you stand back from it all, what do we need to actually do here? Well, you can look at what needs to happen over time. And I suppose for me, the interesting thing is that we've got probably this parliament for as long as it's supposed to last, at least. So out to 2025, possibly a bit of the next parliament. That's the time over which we need to get a net zero policy package in place. All those areas need to be scaled up to full delivery. And then over the kind of period of the 2030s, the early 2030s, all investments really need to be zero carbon. Now, what does that mean? Think about all the cars that we have on the road. Think about replacing your boiler. Think about the big decision in industry, how they're going to be decarbonized. All those investments need to be zero carbon over the 2030s. And then we'll see the benefits. So all those investments flow through the economy. You get the kind of big reductions in emissions. And we build the industries around those things that we need to get to net zero in a way that allows the economy to thrive as well. So it is a bigger thing even than Brexit, believe it or not. And we need the government to lead it.
Yeah, I think we've been using the line bigger than Brexit, longer lasting than COVID, but although it might not seem like that at the moment. I'm just sort of quite interested. We're going on about what the government hasn't done, but actually the UK is quite a good performer on emissions reduction. We have had some quite startling successes, not least in the power sector. I wonder, Chris, if you thought there are any lessons we could be learning from what's worked rather than just sort of always say you haven't quite got this, you've lost focus on that, you don't really have a plan on existing stock of housing and things like that.
I mean, there really are. There's great lessons, actually, from what the UK has done. I mean, you can look at what's been happening to the emissions that the UK produces, the territorial emissions, and you see they've been shrinking for some time whilst the economy has been growing. That's not the story in other similar-sized economies around the world. And one of the reasons that that's happening is because of policy. It's because of a decision over the last 10 or 15 years to decarbonize our power sector. That's great. There's lots and lots of lessons about that. This is a really capital-intensive thing. It's driven by capital investment. So we're going to need to have pretty high rates of capital investment over the next 20, 30 years to get to net zero. That's what we've seen. We've scaled up that capital investment in the power sector, driven by policy with an industry response. We've been closing coal-fired power plants, but we've also been replacing that generation with renewable generation. And it's that story, I think, that we can learn most from. So we have something called a CFD, a contract for difference, which is a means by which the government gives industry price certainty about how much someone who generates that renewable power will get into the future. That's driven down the cost of capital for anyone who's investing in renewables. And it's that style of policy that gives that long-term price certainty that reduces the kind of policy risk, I suppose you could think of it that way, that we need to see in other sectors.
Becky, you want to come in?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons for the success of the power sector is because it's a relatively small and tight-knit group of actors who needed to come together to make that happen. I mean, I would argue actually a bit too tight-knit. I think the energy market should be opened up. But leaving that aside, it was, you know, a relatively small group of organisations and bits of government. And so it's actually pretty different from what we see ahead of us, which is the need for, as Chris was saying, a sort of economy-wide coordination of net zero. If you look at electric vehicles, for example, we need, you know, not just to get the vehicles manufactured, but also to make sure that the electricity is there at the right times of day, that we incentivize consumers to, to charge their cars at the right times of day. That's all kinds of different industries and parts of government. So, I mean, what I think is really useful about your report is that it doesn't just say we need leadership, we need, you know, someone big and charismatic to lead this, but also that there's a, you know, a sort of roll your sleeves up job of delivery. Well, it's less delivery and more sort of coordination or even sort of conducting, where, you know, at the moment we've got loads of players in the orchestra who all want to, desperate to play the music, but there's no one there to conduct. So that job of actually rolling your sleeves up and making sure that everyone is lined up to contribute is what's really needed now. So it was a little bit different, I think, for the power sector.
Tom, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, just to come in on your offshore wind example, just because I think it's a really good question, sort of what can be learned from it, although I very much take Becky's point about the differences. It's a classic example of the opposite of that problem that Emma was talking about earlier, of sort of lack of consistency and lack of sort of joined up policymaking. So you had the price certainty, which Chris was mentioning, but you also had efforts by the Crown Estate, which was interesting for me to learn that actually the sort of is involved in facilitating aspects of getting access to the seabed, which is needed to build sort of offshore wind, but also efforts by the Treasury to secure financing and make that cheaper, and industrial policies which develop the sort of skills that were needed. And we've got some sort of green ports in places like Hull, which is building these turbines. So what you had there was sort of every element of government policy pointing in the same direction and made consistent over a decade or more, which has led to that big success, the fall in price, and that's now a big part of our plans. And that's exactly what's been missing out elsewhere, although Becky's totally right that in other areas, if anything, the challenges are much, much more difficult because you've got a much bigger role for the public in terms of how their behaviour will need to change.
Chris, I just want to come on to the Treasury, because they've been tarred in the past with being a bit sceptical on some of this. I mean, they're there to defend the interests of taxpayers. Certainly it was true when I was at DEFRA that they were a bit slow sometimes to come on board. And they used to regard sort of sustainable development as meaning the fastest possible economic growth now, so we could pay down the line for the necessary cleanups as a much bigger economy with far more resources to deploy. But we wouldn't let that act as a drag on growth now. Do you think the Treasury are on side now? We saw last year that they were, the department, writing letters to Theresa May saying, be a bit cautious about this recommendation from the Climate Change Committee.
This is the critical issue, really, when you look across Whitehall, is what is the attitude of the Treasury? I mean, I'm quite willing to think that they have changed, actually. I mean, even in that letter that you referred to, when Philip Hammond wrote to the Prime Minister, he was accepting the need to set the target. He was highlighting the cost. Now, that strikes me as being the right kind of position for a finance ministry to take, you know, accepting that there is a scientific need, an economic need even, to set that kind of target, but highlighting the implications of it. I mean, the Treasury is a fascinating place. I mean, many years ago, I worked there, and when I worked there, Nick Stern was there when he was doing his world-leading work on the economics of climate change. And at that time, under Gordon Brown, this was a thing they were proud of, you know, kind of owning the kind of intellectual space on the economics of climate change. I think the Treasury forgot that after Nick's departure, they moved into thinking much more about climate change as a cost to be managed. And I think that is, you know, that's the danger here. We need to think of this as a much more fundamental change to the economy. I think the kind of investment level we're talking about actually do have GDP impacts. We're talking about a very pro-economy package, potentially, if we frame it the right way. It's really important that the Treasury view it that way. When we gave our advice last year to government to set the net zero target, we thought carefully about how to approach the Treasury. Instead of telling the Treasury what we thought they should do, we felt it was more important to ask them a question, to say, Treasury, we don't know the answer to the question of how this should be paid for, how it should be paid for fairly, but you should answer that question. And they accepted that. So that's the review that they're now undertaking on the costs of net zero. It is utterly fundamental that they do that well and do it right, because the impacts of that review will be felt for decades afterwards if the principles that come out of it are adhered to.
I do remember someone at the Treasury telling me when I was at DEFRA and we said, well, didn't the Stern Review say we should do something, saying Stern is for foreigners? But anyway, we'll pass on from that. Tom, our report does make some comments about what we think the Treasury might usefully contribute in terms maybe of its part of the plan. What have we got in mind for the Treasury to show actually that they are playing their part on delivery of net zero?
We think there's three big areas that it could focus on. The first is embedding net zero in the next spending review. We think that's going to be later this year still. So actually taking a look at all of government spending and really sort of applying a net zero test to each of those projects and not just looking for a few sort of big ticket infrastructure projects. The second thing we say is to look at the Green Book. So this is the process by which government projects are appraised. At the moment, the way that projects are appraised, they do sort of count the carbon cost, but it's not counted in a particularly satisfactory way. It was described as a bit permissive by some of the people we spoke to. And a lot of interviewees felt that you need something on top of the Green Book, which looks at government's whole sort of carbon budget and how different projects contribute to that. So whether it all adds up. The third thing that we call for from the Treasury is an approach to tax policy that is adapted in light of net zero. So if you look at lots of different areas of policy making, so a good example is electric vehicles, tax policy has often sort of worked against some of the objectives that departments had. And the Treasury has often been unwilling to sort of allow departments to sort of into that conversation about how tax should support that. One of the really interesting things we found looking at other countries, so we looked at some other leaders around the world on climate change, was if you look at the Scandinavians, so sort of Norway and Finland, they use fiscal policy and tax policy in a much more systematic way to sort of drive some of that decarbonisation. So we call for the Treasury to do a review of tax policy.
So your mention of tax policy segues beautifully into talking about the need for public consent, because after all, one of the things that the government, despite all its rhetoric about climate change, has not done over the past 10 years and at very significant cost to the Exchequer is dare to raise fuel duties, even in line with inflation, which as an ex-Treasury person, you know, very difficult to cope with. When I was at the Treasury, we had the fun fuel duty escalator, which was supposed to be signalling the need for people to buy more fuel-efficient cars and to manufacturers to make them in the future. That was, of course, before electric vehicles came onto the horizon. Becky was mentioning the fact that actually the real progress in offshore wind was relatively easy because it involved a few big players and took place quite a long way away from the eye line of electricity consumers, things like that. And that's a point that people were making, commenting on our report, that everything else was a bit more difficult and required a much more complex mix of people to be involved. So one of our big themes in our report is the need for public consent. Emma, do you want to just set out why we think that's so critical?
I mean, I think the main reason it's so critical is because net zero requires everyone to make big changes in their lives. So whether that's, you know, making their homes more energy efficient, we've got to retrofit 28 million inefficient homes, requires people to change their diets, you know, for the most part eating less meat than people do now, to change vehicle, to cycle more, to walk more. You know, these are changes that really go to the heart of the of the way that people live. But if you look at the polls, they suggest that whilst the public are absolutely concerned about climate change, I think as was mentioned earlier, most people haven't heard of net zero. They don't know what it means, let alone having been confronted with the level of change that's going to be required of them over the coming decades. So, you know, politicians really need to start communicating much more about the choices that are ahead if they want to build and maintain support for the kind of policies they're going to have to introduce. So, you know, for a start, that means having a really strong communications plan around the net zero plan that we've been talking about. It's also worth saying that that kind of public engagement and indeed deliberation can help politicians make choices. As you were saying, Jill, I mean, often when it comes to the really difficult choices that we know the public are going to, you know, be concerned about, politicians find ways to duck them. But by actually investing and understanding what citizens think about trade-offs, what citizens' priorities are, what they're most comfortable with, what they're least comfortable with, and how you might go about changing that. And that can help politicians, you know, make the tough choices rather than duck them too.
So, Becky, in a sort of Blue Peter-ish move, politicians have one you prepared earlier, because this Thursday, Parliament's just released the outcomes of its quite prolonged and semi-in-person, semi-virtual Citizens' Assembly, Climate Assembly, looking at just those issues. So, where is the public? Is the public going to be the roadblock to net zero, or is there possibilities of getting the public on board?
The way I tend to caricature this is to say that that there is much stronger public support for action on net zero than politicians think there is, but it's not as much as the environmental groups would like it to be. So it's somewhere in between. But I mean, there's been consistent polling that people are worried about climate change and they want to see government action and leadership. But what there hasn't really been is a proper exploration of that, what that means for the relationship between citizen and state. You know, what are people prepared to do in order to support the country's efforts as a whole? And what will they do if government puts in place the kind of coherent long-term plan that you're talking about? To what extent will they be willing to support it? So one thing that really interested me about the Assembly's findings was that their number one principle, the overriding principle that they wanted to guide their decision-making, was education and information. And this wasn't education in the sense of, you know, just in the sense of add it to the school syllabus, although there was a bit of that. But it was actually much more about government being on the front foot, having an upfront debate with citizens about what the climate challenge means and what the opportunities are, and allowing us to have the kind of national debate, if you like, that citizens who were, you know, that they felt very privileged to be chosen as members of the Assembly. And they felt very lucky that they had the chance to have those debates with politicians, with experts and with each other. And they thought that that debate shouldn't just be going on amongst 110 people in a room in Birmingham, that that should be a nationwide thing. And I think that's what's key to getting support and engagement in this agenda over the next 30 years.
Becky, can you just tell us a little bit about exactly what this was? So this was set up by some parliamentary select committees rather than government itself. Just give us a bit of the sort of modalities of how this all came up and happened.
Yeah, sure. So Climate Assembly UK was commissioned by six select committees in Parliament. And that's brilliant, because going back to what we were saying earlier, those six select committees cover the gamut of where carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions come from. So, you know, housing, local government, treasury, business, right across the range. And so that was a really helpful beginning, the fact that it was such a wide group of committees commissioning it. And they commissioned a group of us, the organisation Involve led on the process, and there were four of us, including myself and Chris, who worked as expert leads, basically providing the advice on the content. And those citizens spent, it was supposed to be four weekends in Birmingham, it was three weekends in Birmingham, followed by a lot of online sessions when COVID hit. They spent that time firstly learning from experts, and then talking amongst each other, and lastly recommending. So it's a sort of three-stage process. And you know, I think the thing that struck me the most about this is that, and the hallmark for me of these processes is that when you give people the time and space and the opportunity to learn and deliberate about something, they come up with really sensible answers. I mean, actually, they must be sensible because they're sort of scarily similar to some of the stuff you've got in your report. People take the job very seriously. They learn huge amounts, and they come up with really sensible work through answers, which take the evidence on board and also take their own lived experience on board. And that's the crucial thing.
And Chris, I think you started off a bit sceptical about spending lots of your weekends talking to citizens about climate change. How was it for you?
Yeah, not so much sceptical about that. I was very willing to do it. I mean, all of the time that anyone involved in this really volunteered, so you know, gave up a huge amount of time to support this process. More time than I thought. So it's incredibly involved putting together a process like this, and really rewarding at the end of it. I suppose what I was sceptical about was whether it would be possible to take 110 representative people from the UK and provide them with enough information that they could make meaningful decisions about, you know, the technical aspects of how you get to net zero. And I suppose this was the arrogance of being in the CCC, thinking that you might need a few spreadsheets to pull that off. Actually, it's fantastic to do it. You have the group of people with varying views on everything, including climate itself. And you have this kind of a constrained question that you put to them, not whether the UK should have a net zero target, but how to achieve the net zero target, and provide them with enough information, answer enough questions that they can have a meaningful discussion of it. And out pops this kind of really well-rounded, sensible, meaningful set of recommendations. I mean, I think if I were a UK minister, I would hug this closely. You think about the demands from Extinction Rebellion, for example, for a different sort of citizens' assembly. The kind of things in this report are things that ministers know they need to do anyway. So, you know, you've got really strong endorsement, actually, for, a kind of sensible, measured programme of things that we need to do to change lifestyles, yes, but to overall get to net zero in a way that carries public support.
So give us a sort of concrete area that a sort of a minister who's, turned up. I think we've got a chart showing how many housing ministers there have been over the past few decades that we've been committed to action on climate change. So they change quite quickly. They come in their brief. They're being told by the Prime Minister they've got to build new housing as their number one goal. We're telling them, but by the way, you've got to tell everybody in the public, in the country, as well, that they need to change how they heat their housing. Actually, that might be the response in the business department, she said, but they have rapid ministerial turn as well. You're a new minister, you've got this across your desk. What could they take out of this assembly in terms of appetite? Some of the comments we've had on Twitter about our report are people saying, does this mean I have to get rid of my new gas boiler? So how do politicians go about sort of addressing that sort of issue? What permissions do they potentially have from the Citizens' Assembly?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the group of people that met and discussed the issues understood the urgency of acting on it, which was, again, I suppose one of the points I was interested in participating in this process was to understand what the reaction to that would be. So it turns out you give a bit of information to them about the issues of climate change, the science of climate change, and they understand immediately that there is a need to act on it. So I would take comfort if I were a new minister, and from that point that you have got public support for this, if it's explained and if we can provide that kind of education more broadly. And then the second thing is that beneath that, in every area of our lives, there is the need for change. And you saw from the recommendations of the Citizens' Assembly a desire to make those changes and yes, to be supported along the way to make them, but also to do some difficult things. So talk about one of the very topical things at the moment is this transport discussion, the date by which we phase out the internal combustion engine vehicle. You know, by what point do you phase out petrol and diesel cars on roads? Grant Shapps has got that on his desk right now. Well, Citizens' Assembly looked at that. They looked at more radical prescriptions. They looked at less radical prescriptions. They've arrived at this kind of idea that actually it's probably best that we do have a date for phasing out internal combustion engine vehicles between 2030 and 2035. And these are people that drive these vehicles, rely on them for work, and are willing to make that kind of change. And they also talked about the need to be supported along the way for tax policy to support those changes too, and a host of other things. But you see that in every area that we were able to discuss with the Assembly, that there is a kind of really sensible, balanced view that emerges once the facts are put before them. I don't know if Becky wants to say something about what happened on that very issue of gas boilers and what to do about it in the home.
Becky.
Yeah, I think the other thing that I would say to that new housing minister is that, you know, the debate has tended to get stuck on, you know, which technology or, you know, which particular policy. But what people were concerned about more than anything was the point that you emphasize in your report around leadership and consistency. And also a very broad conception of fairness, actually. So the kinds of ways that assembly members talked about, for example, how you deal with reducing carbon emissions in the home, it was a lot about fairness, both in terms of, you know, whether you're renting or owning your home, but also in terms of, you know, whether you might have a job in an old fossil fuel industry or whether you might be able to get a job in energy efficiency or retrofit. So what those of us in the bubble might call just transition, that was a real theme coming out. You know, another theme emerging strongly from the work around energy use in the home was the need for sort of local strategies. And I think, you know, the role of local authorities in climate action is absolutely crucial. And if you look at climate policy over the last sort of 10, 20 years, it has tended to be sort of top-down, you know, national plan type stuff. And I think there was strong support among assembly members for tailored local plans, which almost certainly means greater power and responsibilities for local authorities in this area. So managing local plans for home retrofits for zero carbon heating, but also absolutely dovetailing into what needs to be done around transport and land use and so on.
And did you get the sense that people were actually prepared to pay a bit themselves for these changes, or did they just expect some sort of nebulous general taxpayer who wasn't them would pick up the tab?
I mean, they absolutely understood that if there were taxes, they would be paying them. And there was a lot of debate about that, certainly in the theme I looked after, looking at household measures. I think that, again, rather than sort of, you know, whether or not they wanted to pay that tax, it was whether they felt that that was a fair way of making the investment needed. So, you know, they were more likely to be positive about tax if there were alternatives. You know, they were more willing, for example, to have the high carbon heating taxed or even banned outright if there was an alternative that was supported by government that they could implement. So I think they were, you know, definitely thoughtful about tax. And, you know, I remember obviously a recurring theme of the discussion was, you know, we don't want to pay more taxes, but they absolutely understood that government investment is a really important driver of the strategy. And you saw that in their response to COVID as well. You saw very strong support for government investment in order to build net zero into our response to COVID.
Really interesting. Tom?
I just wanted to come back to Becky's point she raised earlier about political consent as well. I thought that was a really good framing of saying people are probably slightly ahead of where the politicians think they are, but not quite where some of the environmental groups would want them to be. And I think one of the challenges here is that actually often public consent for some of these actions is not quite translated into political consent. So there were some interesting studies we looked at around onshore wind, where politicians felt that the public were much, much more opposed to that than they actually were in practice. So I think one of the really interesting questions for government is how do they respond to this climate assembly? As Chris said, they've now got all this data about this really robust, rigorous process that has involved the public. They've got a huge amount of information that they can actually use to say that we've listened and we've based our policy on what the public will accept. But they really need to take it on board and respond to it in their own judgments about where they think the public are.
Becky?
Yeah, just say that example of wind energy is a really good case in point about why we need much more engagement between citizens and politicians on this agenda. Because actually, the reason that communities were saying no to wind power and the reason it became a toxic issue for politicians, particularly in the Tory shires, was because the choice was, do you want this wind farm here? Yes or no. And when a big company is coming to you and saying, do you want this here? Yes or no? You're pretty likely to say no, actually. And it's not necessarily to do with the technology. You can frame that in a completely different way by saying, okay, you know, town X or area Y, you know, we've got to meet these carbon targets. There are real opportunities to be had in this in meeting the targets. Let's talk as a community about how we reach that. So a sort of local area, a local energy area planning approach. And, you know, this has been trialed and it's shown to be way more successful. And in fact, means that people tend to accept the need for technologies like wind farms, even if they don't like the look of them, because they see that as part of the bigger picture and they see the opportunities around that as well. If you can get in some local ownership, so much the better.
It's really interesting. So that's opened up some potential. So we have the potential to get the public on board. Chris has told us we sort of roughly know what to do. We potentially have the Treasury looking at it. So we've got the building blocks there for a plan. The government wants to pick it up and run with it. But one of the sort of eternal Achilles heel, and one that the Institute of Government has studied quite often of UK government policy, is not writing the lovely plan or the policy document or whatever, it's turning it in to delivery. And there are quite a few skeletons in the climate change cupboard, whether we mention the Green Deal, which had very low uptake, the very delayed rollout of smart meters, or the problems in managing the renewable heat incentive, notably in Northern Ireland, which collapsed the Stormont executive for 3 and a bit years. So just want to come back. Emma, we sort of talk in the report about the need for capability. So where are the gaps?
So, I mean, I think there are a couple of big gaps. The first is around science and engineering. So there are all sorts of big challenges, big choices that we know are coming on technology, for instance. Take Bayes' responsibility for the future management of the energy system. To make, you know, these kind of decisions, government needs to have really strong science and engineering advice. But at the moment, it just isn't there. Engineering is massively underrepresented in Whitehall. Even those science advisors that do exist in government at the most senior levels tend to be brought into high-level decision-making in quite a patchy way. So there's a gap there around science and engineering. I think there's also, because this is going to be such a huge issue for government over the coming decades, it's not just about, you know, in having specific engineering capacity or specific scientific expertise, but actually building a kind of pipeline of climate experts. This is going to be one of the most challenging issues government's facing for decades. So I think the civil service also needs to think about how it creates a kind of specific climate change cadre, a kind of fast train cluster, if you like, the leaders in this area of tomorrow. But as you were touching on, Jill, one of the other big kind of capability gaps is around delivery. Whitehall departments often lack project management expertise. They find it difficult to focus on long-term challenges. I think one of the things government needs to do is assess where is there a need for additional capacity to oversee the delivery of some of the really large net zero infrastructure projects that we know are coming, like the mass retrofit of homes, for instance, or the replacement of gas boilers. One of the things we heard a lot about in our research was the case for actually creating a series of arm's length delivery bodies or convening organisations who could oversee some of those delivery challenges to make sure that government really has that delivery capability in place to ensure they actually happen in practice.
Chris, does that make sense to you?
Well, it really does. I mean, when I think about my own work, so we've been doing the job of assessing this progress in the UK and advising on targets now for 12 years. I frankly think that that job is going to become very boring if that's all we do. So when I look into the future, the CCC as an institution needs to be the place that is providing expertise on how to deliver. So I think that's going to be a big pivot point for us in the years ahead. And if that's true for us, it's definitely true for government. I mean, I'm much happier discussing this now as a delivery challenge than some sort of, a kind of fantasy goal. You know, it's much, much more than a target. It really just needs to be turned into a set of delivery challenges. And as you say, that hasn't always been something that government's been good at. I think there are still some big delivery challenges in sectors where the government has delivered. We've talked about energy, for example, and I think, the need to scale up investment in the energy sector is something I'm pretty confident we can do. When you look out beyond the power sector into things like the home retrofit question we've returned to several times in this discussion, how to change the use of land across the country, even the transport challenges. These are big delivery questions where the policies aren't even in place yet. These are not areas where we've tried policy. So, delivering well is going to involve us very quickly getting up to the point where we can be confident that those policies are going to deliver and then overseeing that delivery. And that is a very different challenge from the one that faced us as we really embarked on this challenge of cutting emissions in the UK. So I think it's much more exciting to think of it that way. But it's also much more difficult.
Tom?
So I think this just connects to some of the civil service reform agenda that sort of Messrs. Johnson and Cummings have been setting out in recent weeks. So you've heard complaints throughout the sort of coronavirus pandemic that the Cabinet Office is not fit for purpose. It's been described as bandit country, and you've had ministers saying you pull at levers and nothing happens. And actually net zero, really all of the challenges that we've been talking about, it's the perfect test case for this kind of much stronger sort of centre that can really drive change through the whole system, across all of government, down through regulators and local government and so on. And if you're going to have this kind of NASA-style control centre that Dominic Cummings is talking about, with all the live data and the much bigger focus on technical skills and expertise and science and engineering and so on, then really it makes sense for that to be the place where net zero is driven, and a lot of those challenges very much align with some of those that the government has already identified.
Interesting. Emma?
Yeah, I think one of the dangers with delivery capability is that, government reverts to the kind of classic model of designing policies and then bringing in the delivery expertise once those policies have been formed. And as we know, that's often why policies fall apart, why they fail in practice, because it's designed by policymakers, over at one end, and then chucked over the wall to people who are going to deliver it at the other end, when actually you really need that delivery expertise incorporated into the policy design. And so I think government needs to start thinking, about delivery and about what capability it needs now, rather than waiting until policies have been created and formed.
Becky, you mentioned earlier the sort of role of local government, the potential for local government. And we've seen, when we were going around talking to people in local government, there was a lot of enthusiasm. And I think local government's quite helpful potentially in mobilising consent. But we also got a very big sense that 10 years of cuts had hollowed out the capacity to do things in local government. So what do you think needs to happen to enable local governments that are enthusiastic to help the government deliver on net zero?
I would favour devolving carbon targets to local areas, but only if you give them the resources alongside the responsibility. And, if you look at what we need to crack over the next decade or so, it's land use, it's transport, it's basically a whole load of local government stuff. And it would be incredibly difficult for national government to do that. So I think a canny strategy for government would be to devolve, but a terrible strategy would be to devolve a target without any means of delivering it.
That's a useful warning there. I mean, the one bit that sort of local authorities actually now have a very big role on, and we haven't talked much about it, it's a sort of Cinderella of the climate change story, but shouldn't be, is adaptation to climate change. Chris, the Climate Change Committee's been pretty critical of where we are, suggesting actually we've gone a bit backwards over the last 10 years on preparedness for the impacts of climate change. What do you think needs to happen to get us back into a good place on adaptation?
I very much agree with the premise of your question. I mean, I think the oddity is that we have we have this Climate Change Act, which we've been talking about, which has been guiding us now for 12 years, and now has this new target, net zero, to reduce emissions. Well, the Climate Change Act also has another part to it, which deals with what we call adaptation. So, you know, our plans to adapt to climate change itself. It's much less sexy. It hadn't had nearly the same attention as the other side of the house, and it really needs it. And you know, it's pretty urgent. And I suppose that at the core of it is this problem that it's not so shiny. So you can achieve net zero. It works as a sort of mission. And adaptation is more like a process. You know, you need to accept that there is something coming, get ready for it, and continue to adapt. And it is getting warmer in the UK. It's worth saying that. You know, we are seeing summer temperatures over 35 degrees fairly commonly now in the southeast, particularly. I reckon we'll cross the threshold of a 40 degree centigrade day pretty soon. That's what's driving change. Now, we are not adapted to that style of temperature. We're not adapted to the changes in weather that come with it, heavy rainfall, more extreme heat waves like we had in recent years. They are going to happen more frequently. There's higher sea levels that we know are coming too. These are all things that we know. I think they mean more to people than ethereal concepts of, you know, what we do about greenhouse gas emissions. That's the other oddity about this. So connecting that up is something that the government really should try and do. And the Act requires it. This is the other interesting thing about it. Now, when we've looked at the program that's in place, which is owned by DEFRA, and assessed what's in it, we see one that's just not at all fit for the kind of climate risks that DEFRA themselves say the UK faces. So we don't have a complete plan. We need a national plan, but the crucial difference is that this isn't like emissions reduction, where you can have national policies very easily, at least. Adaptation is a messy old business. It involves local changes. It involves adapting to things like flooding, which is very different in one part of the country from another. So although there is a need for a national plan, there is a need for a set of coherent local plans to go with that. And that has not been traditionally something that the government has been very good at doing. And couple that with the fact that this isn't a very optimistic message that we're giving you. You know, we're talking about even if we achieve the kind of global temperature, the global emissions targets that the Paris Agreement implies, we're still going to be adapting to at least another half a degree of centigrade of warming, which is going to coming with it. And there's going to be a lot of change in the environment and the weather that we experience. So I desperately want to make that point, because your report's brilliant on net zero, but we need an equivalent focus on adaptation. Again, that's something you're going to see the CCC kind of up the volume on as well in future years.
Yes, and it's quite interesting that that's the one question where everybody says, but what's that? Whereas nobody says that about emissions reduction. Mm. I just wanted to finish on the sort of global picture, Chris and Becky. We should be 2 months away from hosting the Conference of the Parties in Glasgow, the sort of big follow-up to the Paris conference 5 years ago. Government's been bought a bit of extra time by COVID. That's now going to be next year. We all know that UK emissions alone, even if we went to net zero tomorrow, wouldn't stop climate change in its tracks. So what needs to happen to make a success of the COP? What does the UK need to do? What do you think the prospects are? Becky?
Well, I'm not an expert at all on the international negotiation side, but I'm sure Chris will have a view on that. But I think an absolutely crucial part of it is for the UK to lead on delivery the way that it's led on targets. I mean, it's incredible the effect that the climate change had on the national picture, on the international picture. And you know, I think the plaudits that we've had for the Climate Change Act are absolutely well deserved. It's interesting that the Climate Change Act was the beginning of the sort of burgeoning of legal approaches to climate change, and actually the use of the use of litigation in other countries. So the Climate Change Act was absolutely world leading. And, you know, if we can get our delivery similarly world leading within the next few months to a year, then I think that's one of the ways that the UK could really influence a successful negotiation.
Chris?
Yeah, I'm sitting here today. I'm in Glasgow. It's my hometown. So I'm joining you online from Glasgow. And it's a kind of strange thing to think that in 15 months, I think I worked it out as, we'll have, I hope, most of the world leaders in Glasgow to discuss climate change. In particular, if it's a Joe Biden presidency, that should electrify the COP next year. So, you know, there's a kind of really important moment, never mind climate change, really important diplomatic moment for the UK to be in that presidency. And it's not the only presidency we'll have over that period, but the G7 as well. So it's, and, you know, you couple that with what's happening on COVID, you know, the COP is going to come at a point when multilateralism is being tested in ways that we haven't really tested before. And we're going to come together, I hope, at a point when, you know, we'll have 18 months of world leaders trying to stimulate their economies. Now, the key thing for me is that it's not just about that event next year, it's about the run-up to it. So the presidency of the COP, the presidency of the G7, if it's going to mean something, and it means the UK trying to stimulate activity in the right areas so that we get on the kind of emissions curve that we need to meet the Paris Agreement, that needs to be a story not just about fixing the environment, but also the economy. So that's the kind of key thing when it comes to leadership. Now, the UK has a lot to say about those things. We are one of the developed economies that has done most on cutting emissions, and we've done that without shrinking the UK economy. That's a really important story. The story we were talking about earlier on offshore wind is a story that will have implications for other countries around the world. So we've used domestic policy to drive the cost of offshore wind down to the extent that other countries that want to use that now have a cheap source of electricity. That means that we have more leadership perhaps on those issues than we thought we did. So I would like to see us come together, and then for the stories that the UK has been leading to be a kind of part of the leadership of COP next year, there's so many exciting elements to that. And the last thing I'll say on this is that kind of interesting thing for me is that the UN process for climate change is all about national plans. But actually, if you look in those national plans, I suspect they're going to disappoint. So, you know, what we need to do is look through the national plans and look at the global transitions that are taking place beneath that on power, the phasing out of coal, on transport, the adoption of electric vehicles, and a host of other challenges where, again, the UK's got a lot to say. I think those are the stories that are going to make the COP a success next year. It's not just what we're doing in the UK. It's our willingness to embrace those big changes. So it's a massive task, and it won't happen unless the Prime Minister and the most senior people in government really embrace it.
I think what started out as a very big agenda has just got quite a lot bigger with that set of challenges that Chris laid down. But I think the memo to the Prime Minister, and thanks very much to the Prime Minister for listening to the end of this podcast, is that you really do have an opportunity to make the first outing for Global Britain, one of genuine world leadership, if you make a success of your COP next year. But one of the key things you need to do is to show that you actually have a plan and the capabilities to deliver domestically. So very many thanks to Becky and Chris for joining us, and many thanks to Emma and Tom. And just finally, please do read our report. Let us know what you think about it. Thanks very much for listening. And do listen to loads of other fascinating IFG podcasts. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this edition of IFG Live. Please do subscribe to hear more. And if you'd like to know about our upcoming events, please visit instituteforgovernment.org.uk/events.